So I just got back from the Great Vow Zen Monastery outside of Clatskanie, Oregon, kind of northwestern Oregon, a couple hours towards the coast from Portland, right near the Columbia River. The Zen group down there bought an elementary school, a surplus elementary school, about 10 years ago, and turned it into a Zen monastery, so it's a newish Zen monastery. And the reason why I was there was for the biannual meeting of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. And what the Soto Zen Buddhist Association is, SZBA, everything has acronyms, SZBA, is it's an association of Soto Zen teachers, all ordained teachers. And it's a really interesting experiment because of the history of our way. In North America, it was mostly brought by Asian teachers who were trying to sort of get out from under the whatever the establishment was in Asia. So they were fairly individual teachers to start with, each one kind of bringing their, you know, take or their version of what they were trained in, making some changes based on what they thought would be helpful to American students. But then in each group, and now we have second and third generation teachers, American and Canadian teachers, and actually there was a guy from Mexico and somebody from Colombia, so north a little and south a little bit. Anyway, their successors now even more sort of individual and separate, and every one, especially the older folks in the room, had worked really hard, had to work really hard to establish these places. And you could just see that in the way they moved and the way they talked, that each one had made a huge effort over many, many years to establish and continue Zen practice in America. So these are really our heroes and our ancestors, our living ancestors, with the no longer living ancestors right behind them, just right behind them. One of them told me, I don't do anything without feeling my teacher in my body. Washing dishes, walking, my teacher is always with me. And so since they started so separate, it's kind of a miracle that they've managed to create this association, and they come together every other year for a long meeting. And one of the things that they do at that meeting is a ritual. Because, Japan, where this came from, has a more elaborate, system. And part of the system in Japan is that you do a special, the priest, fully ordained priest, before they become a teacher or go back and take over the home temple, and many of them have temples like a family business. Before you do that, after the Dharma transmission ceremony, which we do, you do a special ceremony at the big monasteries, the two biggest monasteries in Japan. And so they concocted in this association a way to do a similar ceremony here on native soil. So it's kind of like being welcomed into the community. And so they have like all of the people who've previously done this ceremony, your seniors are sort of out in the seats where you are, and then in the middle space where I was were all the new, newer people. And there were 27 of us. And there were 90 people in the Zendo, every one of them ordained. So that's pretty interesting. And so they concocted a way to kind of honor this completion ritual that's done in Japan, but do it in a way that feels right to us. And some people in this group have connections to Japan, and they still fly to Japan and do that ceremony. And Norman did that ceremony. That was the excuse for the trip that we took with him a couple of years ago to Japan. So that was what was happening. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about it. And they also, like lots of conferences, they bring in some keynote speakers. And so one of the two keynote speakers they brought was a scholar, a Buddhist scholar named Dale Wright, who's at Occidental College in Southern California, scholar of Zen Buddhism. And that's interesting too, that the scholars all have some practice background and some resonance and respect for practice. That's kind of new. There used to be scholars who were just like kind of, more at a distance from the actual practice. And so Dale Wright had practice, and what's funny, the scholars, the ones that you talk to now, they always say, oh yeah, I went to such and so, and I worked with such and so teacher, and I try to practice, but I'm no good at it. They always say that, I'm no good at it. So he said that. But what Dale Wright chose, and Dale Wright has written many interesting articles, and he's co-editor on many very important recent books on Dogen, on Soto Zen. There's one called Soto Zen Ritual that I really like. I think it's called Zen Ritual. He's one of the editors. What he chose to talk to us about it was very courageous, I thought. He got up there in front of a room of 90 Zen priests, most of many abbots and heads of orders and, you know, important people in our funny little world, you know. And he said to them, well, I'd like to tell you what the strengths and challenges are of Soto Zen in America. So I thought that was pretty ballsy, you know. You know, excuse me for using that in that metaphor, pretty courageous. And so I thought I would share with you what Dale Wright's idea of the strengths and challenges of Soto Zen in America are. And I'm also trying to learn how to do short talks so we can get out of here and be like really done at 9 instead of sort of lingering and getting tired. So I'll try to be brief, or maybe I'll just do half of it, you know, and just, maybe our new Ina will just like ring the bell. That'll be it. Sorry. So the first strength of Soto Zen, according to Dale Wright, is that at their core, the practices themselves support very positive human qualities: mindfulness, concentration, compassion. That the practice, the core practice of Zen itself, Zazen and the container and teachings around Zazen, support people in becoming excellent human beings, was the phrase he used, excellent human beings. And the second thing he said was connected to that first one, which is that those practices are really taken seriously in Soto Zen. And this is really, I think, a strength of Soto Zen. No matter how long you've practiced, you're still, you know, we don't have like, oh, I'm done with, I finished my Zazen studies and now I'm just, you know, everyone does in some way the same practice. Everybody involved from first time to 40 years is still sort of coursing in the same practice. So the practice itself is taken seriously. And Dale Wright is a scholar of all kinds of religions. He knew about, you know, he speaks five languages or something. I forget what they all are. German, French, English, Japanese, Chinese, I think. So he knew about lots of other religions. And he said, in other religions, you tend to have specialists who really do the practice, and other people do other things. And in Zen, it's fairly consistent that everyone does the practice. You know, even the people working in kitchen and administrative jobs. And then the third thing, these are all very much aspects of the same thing. The third thing he said is that, and I just have some brief notes, but I noticed that my colleague who was there, Grace Shearson, wrote a little article about all this that she put on the Sweeping Zen website. So you can read a lot more about this if you go to sweepingzen.org. And this last one, my note isn't very good. I just have Zen mind as substrate for all, the depth dimension of Zen. So let's see what Grace wrote about this third one. She wrote, a third point is that Zen mind is not localized to a specific cognitive skill or a specific area of development. Developing awareness will shine light on many skills and abilities. If you want to create art, it may energize your art. If you're a school teacher, your Zen mind awareness will inform your relationships to your students. If you are a bus driver, Zen meditation may shine light on your relationship to your vehicle, your route. As a writer, Zen may help you free your voice or inspire the content. And then she goes on, while some may think that attaining Zen teacher status is the aim of Zen training, that is deluded thinking and grasping. We need to re-examine that belief. The luminous beauty of Zen can be poured into everything: activism, art, parenting, work in the world, marital relationships. We need to see that mindful attention to the altar is the same attention we give to each other. And she goes on about just the spirit of that. So yeah, so Zen mind is a universally applicable attitude or stance, is maybe the third one. And the fourth one I think you'll find interesting, which is, from Dale Wright's point of view, Zen is one of the best religions in terms of just staying grounded, grounded in ordinary, everyday things. The way he put it was that Zen sets aside the otherworldliness of religion with its here and now attitude. Which is interesting, because people come in here and they're like, oh man, I'm going to Vipassana, this is like very otherworldly. But if you hang around for a while, you feel that, I think. You feel that the purpose of this ritual and container is actually just to be right here in the room, not to be transported to some Buddha field somewhere. So groundedness and setting aside otherworldliness. The fifth one actually just came up in a conversation I was just having. You know how, have you ever seen some Christian denominations, you can get the brochure and it says, this is what we believe, and there's a list of core beliefs, and you want to be on board with that or you're not going to be happy in the congregation. So Dale Wright's fifth item in the list of strengths of Zen is that that does not exist. That there is no list of required beliefs. And then we got into a whole riff about rebirth, which is a troublesome one for us. From Dale's point of view, even belief, not believing in rebirth is okay. But there are some schools of Buddhism that do value that sense highly, mostly to the Tibetans who inherited it from the Indians. So that's one that requires further discussion, and there's lots of discussion after his talk about rebirth. People are like, well, wait a minute, what about rebirth? And he also quoted Stephen Batchelor at that point. I don't know if you know who Stephen Batchelor is. He's an English meditation teacher who studied for a long time in Tibetan Buddhism and ended up kind of rejecting some of the Tibetan cosmology and kind of creating something he calls secular Buddhism. But Dale, who knows Stephen, said, you know, Stephen, you don't have to do that, because I say you can just be a Buddhist and not have to worry about believing in rebirth or believing in anything. You don't have to believe in anything. So that was his fifth strength. The sixth strength was that there is not really conflict between Zen understanding and our modern scientific understanding. And like the Dalai Lama famously said, you know, if science disproves some aspect of Buddhism, we should abandon that belief. Although he also really believes in rebirth and can tell you all about, you know, different tulkus have been reborn, so it's interesting. So much is interesting about the human mind. But Dale was saying basically, compared to many other world religious systems, Zen is more friendly with modern scientific understanding. Maybe sees that there are some limits to modern scientific understanding, and that maybe there's some sense of consciousness and life that's beyond science, but doesn't deny science. The seventh one, I'm doing really good. The seventh one is that Zen has a strong focus on freedom. On freedom. And not the freedom that we think of, sort of our stereotypical American freedom, is the freedom to do or what the heck you want. Not that kind of freedom. Freedom from suffering. Freedom from desire. Freedom from conditioning. And that's what we're going to study all this coming weekend. You know, how do the teachings of Buddhism support freedom? Freedom to really be yourself in the middle of any situation. So not free of something, but free in something. I mean, that's what it is. Buddhism and Buddhism in general focuses on freedom in the middle of whatever's happening. That even in an apparently very restrictive situation, there's freedom there. That was his number seven, a focus on freedom. Number eight is playfulness and humor. That the strict masters are juxtaposed by play, by the joy of letting go. I wrote in my notes, serious play. You know, Zen is kind of serious play. That's not, he didn't say that. And he gave a quote from, I forget which century, this. He gave a quote from someone named Yakusan, so Japanese, clearly. Poem by Yakusan, where he said, once up high on a lonely mountain peak, the clouds parted. Uproarious laughter. Once high on a lonely mountain peak, so it was like a hermit, right? Once high on a lonely mountain peak, the clouds parted. Uproarious laughter. And that Zen specializes in the belly laugh, right? So at the center, not the but the belly laugh. So that was number 8. For me, I'll finish the strengths and we'll do the weaknesses and challenges another night, because we're going to have more regular, shorter talks in this new plan if we do this. So number 9 is the emphasis on going beyond the master, going beyond the master. So a really strong encouragement to be go beyond imitation. Start with imitation, go beyond imitation. So that the Zen tradition has a built-in sort of innovation to it and adaptability to different cultures and places and times, apparently. That seems to be working, because here we are. There's no Japanese people in the room, you know. So that seems to be true. It's going beyond the master. And that there's some tension there, certainly. Tension with the sense of mind-to-mind transmission, like you receive some particular understanding from your master. Well, how can you go beyond that if that's exactly what you receive? So it's interesting, but there's this emphasis on creativity and innovation, which is also interesting because it grew up in a culture of apprenticeship, you know, that highly values imitation. So kind of taking the next step. His number 10 is the Zen aesthetic sensibility. So embracing the arts as practice, weaving cultural arts through Zen practice, you know, monks doing calligraphy and lay practitioners practicing singing and theater and tea, the tea bowl. And Dale talked a lot about that. He really got jazzed about the Zen aesthetic and wanted to make sure he was kind of counseling us, you know, coaching us, like, don't let that go, you know, just become sort of meditation, you know, boring meditation people. Keep the arts in your centers. So we can do that. We've made some little experiments here, but we'll keep working on more art. And then his last one, the 11th strength of Zen, according to Dr. Dale Wright, is the Zen literary tradition. The way that Zen absorbed the teachings of early Buddhism that we'll study this weekend and wove them into narrative and story and the famous koan literature, the stories of the masters, you know, and so on. And now we're unearthing more and more stories about women practitioners. And there's a very important book coming out by colleagues of ours, Stories of Women Practitioners. But the same thing, the literary tradition of bringing forth this sense of how to live in the world empowered by Dharma and by teachings and using example. And, you know, and then their humor is in there too, you know, the master and student at their serious play, you know. And there's lots of examples of that. That was his 11. I thought of a 12th. So I'll add my 12th and then I'll stop. The 12th, I think, is that our tradition really trains us from the inside out to become more comfortable with suffering, to be able to feel discomfort, difficulty, the things we don't want to feel in ourselves and in others, and be able to just be with that, not rushing, jumping up instantly to fix it. And there's so much possibility for healing in that. So I think that kind of imbues the whole thing. So I grabbed him later and told him he should add that to his list. Maybe he will. Really nice man, you know, very. And then he was so fascinating. After the talk, he hung around for a couple more days of the conference and just kind of watched us in action. You know, he's always in the back of the room. And one of his colleagues actually wrote an article about that ceremony I was telling you about. So I said to him, you know, if Bill Bodefer can get an article out of that ceremony, you should be able to get a couple articles out of this, you know, meeting. And he said, oh yeah, maybe 3. Because we were, at that moment, what we were debating, when I told him that, was we were debating establishing standards for training of Soto Zen monks in America, and as you can imagine, there was much discussion. And areas, and you know, our skillful facilitators were trying to focus on the areas of agreement, but there were plenty of areas of not so much agreement, so that'll be an emerging story. Because the way it's grown, you know, because that's back to my opening, right? The way it's sort of evolved in very separate places, separate lineage, separate teachers, separate kinds of establishments. Places that are like monasteries where people live full-time for many years. Places like this that are in a town where either people live here, which is one kind of way of practice, or they don't live here like we do. So they were recognizing these different modes of practice and trying to kind of figure out, you know, what do we have in common, but. So that was a little difficult, but it was an honor. You know, it was really such an honor to get to be there and meet old meet new friends and reacquaint myself with old friends, including people that I knew a little bit, you know, in the late 80s at San Francisco Zen Center and have seen maybe once or twice since. And including Tygen Layton says hello. Do you remember Tygen? Oh, John, he so treasured that trip you took here. He always talks to me about that when I see him. Yeah. This lovely teacher who now teaches in Chicago.
Oh, he's in Chicago?
He's in Chicago, a place just a little bigger than this. And he's got a couple ordained students, and he teaches a lot. He's a real scholar. And we brought him here one time for a weekend retreat. And it happened to be when the salmon were running up Whatcom Creek, mm-hmm. the chum. It was like a really strong chum. Mm-hmm. It's like every other year it's a big run. And it happened to be one of those times. And he was like, oh, it's wall-to-wall salmon. He was telling his students, oh, you got to go to Bellingham. They have this like wall-to-wall salmon in this creek. And it's amazing. You know? So there's a few words from the Soto Zen Buddhist Association meeting and a little about our tradition. And wasn't that interesting to kind of reflect mm-hmm. on that? And we can think about that some more. Like, we're in the middle of this thing, you know, whether we like it or don't like it or have our feelings or whatever our relationship in it, we're right in the middle of this, you know. And to get a little perspective on what is it we're doing, you know, what are the strengths of it, and then I'll tell you later what our problems are. Thank you very much. Thank you.